I'm Christopher Lydon. In a three-way gab around the evidence that God is back in the bookstores, in popular culture, in world affairs, this is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it, from the Watson Institute at Brown University. This one is a book fair exchange that caught fire around a current version of the old graffiti duel, God is dead, signed Nietzsche, then Nietzsche is dead, signed God. In the last few years, neo-atheists, including Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, and Richard Dawkins, have buried God again in best-selling books. But this season, here come Karen Armstrong, Robert Wright, and, at the Boston Book Festival last weekend, novelist Mary Gordon, a progressive Catholic who leaves plenty of room for doubt, and then the postmodern Baptist theologian Harvey Cox, and Cornel West, the lay preacher and blues man, as he calls himself, each of them writing and talking up a storm about the hunger, maybe for a personal God or gods, but also for blessed communities in his or her name. In a jammed hall of the Boston Public Library, I asked the writers not to summarize or sell their new books, but to imagine that we were in a train compartment between, say, Istanbul and Vienna, just talking about the God question. Harvey Cox led off for Mary Gordon, and then Cornel West.
Let me put it very, very sharply, as sharply as I can, in the form of a question to you and to my two colleagues. Here we are at the beginning of the 21st century, and what seems to be happening, is a recrudescence of religion everywhere you look. Not just fundamentalisms, but all kinds of religious movements that a lot of people had declared dead and gone. 50 years ago. They weren't going to go anywhere. They were going to be marginalized. They were declining. That didn't happen. Instead, in a rather massive way, the religious dimension of human life is back. And it's back in public life. It's back in culture. It's back in popular culture. It's back on the bookshelves. It's back in the curricula. It's back in discussions. Not everybody, of course, saying, yeah, amen, but at least right there in the atmosphere, it's really arousing interest, and I think that's a very good thing. We have that. On the other side, we have a kind of strange nihilism, and almost a cynical nihilism, declaring all of this to be merely obscurantism and superstition, not realizing that underneath the surface manifestations, perhaps both of the nihilism and of the renaissance of faith, there's a profound need in our whole civilization, a hunger for something, a reaching out for something. I refer to this as the age of the spirit. That may be a little bit too optimistic. There is that hunger there. There's something that might even be called a pre-religious form of faith. A need to acknowledge something deeper, something mysterious, something beyond our capacity to control it, to manipulate it, to use it for our own advantage. A need to do that, and at the same time, a deep dissatisfaction with the scaffolding and packaging in which our symbols and liturgies of the sacred have been handed on to us. A lot of distrust of that. I sense that among my students. I think you probably do too. I think it's one of the things that draws people to reading people like Mary Gordon. Let me repeat again, this book, Reading Jesus, is absolutely, should be on the top of your list, because she not only reads the Gospels in a way that's going to make you, wake you up, but reads them in terms of her own personal life and history and her command of other kinds of literature. Which I find utterly fascinating and awakening. So here we are. We're at the crossroads. And we're at the crossroads in a critical moment of the development of world civilization in which the two great religious prophets of the 20th century, Martin Luther King and Gandhi, in my mind, what they envisioned and what they strove for, both of them paid for it with the price of their life, was a world in which violence and acquisition and cruelty would somehow be overcome, and we would have what Martin Luther King liked to call a beloved community, a community in which we can support and love each other and aren't set against each other as the price of success. We have this crisis that we're facing, and as we face it, we are inundated. We just talked about this over coffee before we came in, absolutely inundated by a consumer, entertainment, technological culture, which is inducing in all of us a kind of a cultural attention deficit syndrome. We can't really concentrate. We can't go inside very long into ourselves to find that connection between the inner me and the cosmos and the flow of history that religions have dealt with over the years. We can't seem to do that. We're distracted. As T.S. Eliot said, distracted from distraction by distraction. He foresaw that in his great poetry. So I am here not to pose any answers to this. I think that faith is a basic and irreducible human need. Let's call it, for the moment, pre-religious faith. That need for something to give your life direction, value, meaning, some connection with what's gone before and what you hope for in the future. We can't live without that. And yet the way in which it's been handed on to us seems problematical, thus arousing the suspicion and attacks of people like the so-called new atheists and all those folks. So I'm simply posing this to two people whose opinions I really would love to hear on this very score. What do we do as a writer to make some tiny contribution, if possible, to making this transition that we all know is needed? We can't go on this way. We can't go on destroying the planet, stacking up nuclear weapons. We've got to change. We have to change very fundamentally. What can we do as religious teachers, religious philosophers? So I simply await.
And the question goes to Mary Gordon. Can you answer half of them, Mary?
Harvey always creates the large questions, which the rest of us have to spend the rest of our lives answering. That's what he does for us. I'm the amateur in the group. I'm a fiction writer, mainly. And so why did I feel it was a good time to write this book right now? To take up the notion of distraction and technology, I always like to, as a fiction writer, ask the questions, what are you afraid of? What are you hungry for? And what do you desire? And I think that religion ideally can answer those questions. In practice, it has often short-circuited them. What made me think I ought to write a book about Jesus was my anxiety about the fundamentalists. And it seems to me that there are two large narratives in the world today, the narrative of fundamentalism and the narrative of consumerism. And they're very linked. Both of them are flattening narratives. Both of them say, if you buy something, if you buy enough, that'll make you feel better and you won't have to think. Fundamentalists say, we'll tell you what to think, so you really don't need to think. And it seems to me what is called for is compassion, because people want distraction, consumption, possession, because they feel overwhelmed. And I would say the central somatic reality of our lives now is feeling overwhelmed. There's too much. Just too much information, too many conflicting stories. How do you possibly... We know that a lot of things that we thought we knew didn't turn out to be true. And there are no strong narratives to replace the narratives that we thought worked. So it seems to me many people just feel like we're in the middle of a whirligig. And that's very frightening and it's very distressing. We know what we've lost. We don't know what there is to be found. So what I think a text like the gospel does, most importantly, is to say everything is a lot more complicated than you thought, but we can endure that. And that's why, to me, hope, the greatest of these seems to me to be hope, because it's, if you look at the narratives of Jesus, they're contradictory, they are complex, they tell you everything isn't going to work out really well all the time. It might work out in some way that you would never even have thought of or even have had the language or the imagery for, but you are accompanied. And it seems to me the most important sentence in the Gospels for me comes in the Gospel of John: I come that you may have life and have it more abundantly. And so what do these religious texts offer us? The possibility of a larger life. That larger life is makes life not simpler, but more complicated, but it makes it deep. The thing that makes me worried about what is called the new spirituality now, which always makes me look for the exit sign when I hear spirituality or see the spirituality sign in a bookstore, is it's not Martin Luther King and Gandhi. It's very privatistic. It avoids the larger ethical questions. It avoids questions of justice. And it's kind of me and God, me and the cosmos, me and mystery. And it seems to me that the genius of all the great religious traditions is that, as E.M. Forster says, they connect. They connect the mystery with our responsibility to feed the hungry, to keep the planet alive. The only thing that Jesus says is going to separate the sheep from the goats is not feeding the hungry. What really fascinates me is there's almost nothing about sex in the Gospels. There's a little bit about divorce. I'm not crazy about that, but I didn't write it. But the genius of all the great religious traditions is how do we behave on earth toward our fellow human beings who are all one before the divine, and how do we have a personal relationship with the divine? So what I worry about is the excessive privatism a lot of the new religion, and the notion then that I would add Oscar Romero to one of the great religious prophets of the 20th century. It's a very difficult task to be a religious person because you have a lot of work to do all the time. Ideally, what a religious life gives you is the nourishment that feeds you to go on. And what I'm worried about is you have the institutions which, like my lovely church last week, said, come to us. We don't have all these problems with gays and women. We just don't let them in. So if you don't like gays and women, come on in. Why then would you have any desire to be part of such an institution as that? So the institutions are losing credibility, forcing people into a kind of privatism, which I think short circuits the ethical dimension that's got to be part of a religious life as well.
Mm. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Brother West, pick up the ball.
First, I just want to salute Sister Deborah Porter for bringing us all together. The book, Boston Book Festival, is a beautiful thing. So I was talking about Sister Deborah Porter bringing us all together. Anytime I get a chance to be in dialogue with Brother Christopher Lighton, we just have a good time, very much so. Harvey Cox, you all know, is a legendary figure. 44 years ago was Secular City, and 27, 28, 29 books later, he's still going strong. Still going strong. 44 books. Millions of copies sold. Millions of copies sold. And then Sister Mary Gordon. My God, the classic Final Payment. And she and I remember just dancing at the Grand Central Station together. We want to get the body into the conversation. We want to get dancing in the conversation. We want music. We want art in the conversation, too. And I, like Brother Harvey said, I want you to buy their books. Very, very much so. But let me start first. Let's go back to three of the great historical sociologists who gave us an analysis of what religion would look like. Some were more wrong than right. But Weber said there would be secularization that would become ubiquitous. There would be a disenchantment of the world that would lead toward an iron cage where people would be, in fact, yearning for God talk, but giving it up because science and technology would become so hegemonic, would become so influential, that person would no longer opt for narratives that invoke God or grace and so forth. Now, Weber was wrong about secularization, but he was right about the iron cage. He was right about the iron cage. Durkheim said that there would in fact be something, there's something in eternal in religious sensibilities to the degree to which human beings are going to worship something. They're going to treasure something. The question is, what will it be? Conrad in Heart of Darkness said what? It's idolatry, it's Kurtz, and it's ivory. But they're going to treasure something. The question is, will it be something outside of their ego, their tribe, their clan, their nation? Will it be transcendental? Will it be universal? Will it be cosmopolitan? And then here comes Karl Marx. That says, oh, this religious talk is just sigh of the oppressed. Of course, people want to live in a world in which they have some sense of wholeness. But like George Santayana, who defined religion as what? Religion is the love of life and the consciousness of impotence. That's Santayana. He's a naturalist, religious, but in no way Christian or anything else. He agrees with Marx. Religion is fundamentally about coming to terms with your limits. You're going to die. Your bodies will be the culinary delight of terrestrial worms one day. You can't get around it. Can't get out of space and time alive. We all have a death sentence in space and time, as Kafka said, right? So the question then becomes, in this present moment, how do we account for these kinds of narratives? And I would want to argue, I mean, I think the most vicious form of fundamentalism is market, free market fundamentalism. Precisely because what it does is, given the use of sophisticated technology, titillate, stimulate, keep us on the surface, blitz a whole society of the spectacle, and produces spiritual malnutrition. You go to Eugene O'Neill's Wise Man Cometh, you see it. You can't possess your soul by means of possessing commodities. The emptiness of the soul. We cite my dear brother Michael Jackson. I love that brother. He's a soul brother. But, oh my God. Wrestling with depths of spiritual malnutrition in Neverland. And then among our elites, the greedy corporate elites and oligarchs and plutocrats, moral constipation, where the good and the right is just stuck and you can't get it out. You're constipated. And we've seen that over and over again, greed and avarice and thinking they can get away with anything. Obsessed with the 11th commandment, thou shalt not get caught. You just read the business page any day of the week and you see gangster activity. And what do everyday people see? They're overwhelmed. They feel impotent. They feel they can't do anything. They don't organize and mobilize the way they did in the 60s. You see? They feel, oh, so what do you do? Well, maybe I need some God talk or new spirituality or something. And you begin with the individual. We should not confuse the privatistic with the personal. The personal is precious. Each one of us, no matter what color or civilization, we are precious. You got to deal with your personal life. But if you're dealing with the personal, you always already are dealing with the interpersonal, because there's no you without your mama. You didn't birth yourself. No you without your father. You didn't birth yourself. There's no you without your loved ones and your children and your community and so forth. So the personal leads into the communal, the social, in a very, very deep way. And this is why Martin King and Gandhi are so very important, because they understood that, in fact, religious narratives are some of the most dangerous narratives in the world, because they cut so deep. So when they're tied to patriarchy, when they're tied to white supremacy, when they're tied to imperial arrogance, they are lethal, let me put it that way. But they also have prophetic potential. Prophetic potential. Prophetic potential simply means a willingness, and most importantly, a courage to speak about suffering that's rendered invisible by the dominant narratives of the day, and to bear witness based on the courage to speak about that suffering. It could be our gay brothers and lesbian sisters. It could be indigenous peoples. It could be working peoples. It could be black folk. I begin with black folk because my mother's the ultimate Negro. And I start by loving Negroes first because I love her first. My father's co-ultimate Negro. And that kind of self-love then spilled over into Vanilla Suburbs. And it's a lot of spill, but it starts straight at home. And that love is real. Because justice is what love looks like in public. But love is not privatistic at all. It's horizontal across the board. It has to do with structures and institutions, markets, oligarchic economies, states that are colonized by corporate elites. We can go on and on and on.
Can I ask everybody, but starting with Harvey, just for a quick review of the last 100 years, everything
the last 100 years,
everything you say about religion as a human quality, I mean, as much as sex or hunger or lots of other things are, was developed classically by the late great William James. You gave a wonderful talk one time about this sort of secret document in the publishing firm that put that book out, in which one dissenting editor said, forget it, this was 1901, forget it, religion's over, the book has no future, neither does religion. We've been through a whole lot of ups and downs in this kind of consciousness that Cornell and Mary are talking about. Give us a rough flow chart of atheism, post-secularism, the whole, how do we get here? We seem to be back at the starting gate with William James.
Only 100 years, we could go back a couple thousand if you'd like.
Yeah, well, most of us are within the last 100 years.
Yeah, I think what we have seen has been the rise and fall and rise again and no doubt decline again of religious answers to very fundamental, ongoing, perpetual human questions. But religion, as Cornell has said, of course, has its demonic side, has its destructive side. It also has its preposterously self-righteous side.
Absolutely.
And therefore can build itself up, declare itself infallible, create institutions and hierarchies, exclude other people, and all the rest. And in a way, I think all of us who are religious nowadays welcome these, we would welcome really smart atheists. I'm looking around for a really intelligent atheist now. And the current crop don't quite come up to the mark because they really haven't done their homework. Mm-hmm. It's too easy to take right. it down that way. So
got to go back to David Hume, actually.
Oh, yeah, further back, maybe.
Dialogues.
Back to the Greeks
to
or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
So I think we're now cresting on another one of these recurrent crises in which the underlying and ineradicable need for community, for interpersonal connection,
oh, yeah.
for a beloved community that includes everybody, for justice, for meaning. It's there. It's not going away. And the answers given to it, although they all have a certain element of truth in them, have proved inadequate. And now we're trying to move on to something else.
So what does the future look like in the Cox vision?
Yeah, well, the future of faith, it's going to be around. The way I define faith as this underlying pre-religious need and hunger and want for orientation and meaning, but the belief systems that arise from them and will come and go. Some will be kept, others will go. And we shouldn't confuse these belief systems and institutions with the underlying reality of human faith. We're going to need institutions. We can't go the direction of some kind of solo flights individualistic spirituality. We need some kind of corporate way to address these things. This is why I'm so glad you added Oscar Romero to this list. From now on, I'm going to say, I was looking for a trinity anyway, and I only had two. Oscar Romero belongs there. And Oscar Romero is a wonderful example of a guy who made the transition from the hierarchical exclusivist into the vision of a humanity through liberation theology. but still inspired to a great extent by his Catholic mm-hmm. Faith. Mm-hmm. That's where I hope we're mm-hmm. all going.
The lovely treatment of Romero in your book, actually.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes, I do.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciated it.
Mary, can I pick up on something you said, that notion, and a, you know, maybe one of the very first things you take away from the Gospels, the notion that we're all one before the divine. It is a recurring mystery to me how three monotheistic religions, one God, all of us one in the most important sense, how we even indulge, how the churches indulge this sense of some do or die warrior rivalry between the servants of one God. I mean, this is it takes, seems to me, some doing, thousands of years of history maybe, but we should be over it by now, this notion that one God and one people can be righteously divided in his name against each other. What in the world, how did we get here, and what do we do about it? Why aren't more people sort of banging us over the head with that simple thought that one creator can't be rooting for different members of the family to destroy each other?
Well, unfortunately, the texts give a certain amount of justification to the idea that, that there is Yahweh's people and there are people who are not Yahweh's people. Unfortunately, the texts are written by human beings, and human beings are not pure. And it seems to be something that human beings really like to do, to figure out who they are, is to say, I'm not you. And I'm a great believer in original sin. Unfortunately, I don't think baptism takes it away. But I think that there is something wrong with human beings as a species. We're just, we're not perfect. And I don't think there's any religious text that doesn't justify a holy war, unfortunately. Even the Gospels, he who is not with me is against me. I come not to bring peace but the sword. So I think that it's very difficult to be a person of faith and look at the texts carefully and come to terms with the fact that there seems to be an exclusionary impulse that is tied up. Mm-hmm. It's not all that's there, but you can find justification for it. Having said that, I don't know what else to say, because I think there are other things to be found too. But you find what you're looking for. That's what we know as postmodernists. You see whatever it is you can see from wherever it is that you stand. I think, and that's why people who are anti-religious can point to the great texts and say, how can you live by this? How can you say you worship a God? How can you be a person who sings the Psalms which say, I would like to take my enemy's children and smash their faces on the rocks. Yay, God. That stuff is there, and I think it is a grief of being a post-Enlightenment religious person to have to come to terms with these texts that contain in them much that is heinous and dangerous.
Cornell, I wonder how you cope with that, or why are those voices in the texts not overwhelmed by the others? And who would raise the standard of those other voices in our world today?
I think it has a lot to do with the kind of narrow dogmatism and being wedded to certainty in a sophomoric way. I mean, one of the reasons why I pride myself on being a blues man in the life of the mind is because a blues man or a blues woman has a Keatsian sensibility. You see, that negative capability. They're in the midst of doubt, mystery, and doubt. Doubt, mystery, or uncertainty without any irritable reaching at the fact or reason. So that, for example, look at the Christian text. Look at the blues note of Jesus himself. My God, why hast thou forsaken me on the cross? That's a blues moment. That's a Keatsian moment. Here, God's self is calling into question the benevolent power of the supposedly ultimate power of the universe. Now, I like that moment. because it's humanizing. It's connected to a certain kind of humility, which doesn't lead toward paralysis, but it leads toward an attempt to take a stand without it being so excessively self-righteous or even self-righteous at all. But I think in addition to what the blues, in addition to that kind of healthy skepticism, let's call it retail skepticism as opposed to wholesale. Because wholesale skepticism, you end up in the insane asylum. You know, or you end up putting a bullet in your head. Everything's called into question. Retail is just a little step at a time. This don't make too much sense. But I'm going to seek to work this out. But I've got some sense and I'm bringing to it and so forth and so on. Since you got retail skepticism, that's a blues sensibility. But in addition to that, most importantly, I think that it has to do with catastrophe. And this takes us back to, I think, Sister Mary's point about feeling overwhelmed. I think the reason why so many of us feel weary and jaded is not just that we're growing old, but you look at the climate, you look at greed running amok, and you look at bigotry, and you look at the collapse of the educational system, you say to yourself, this is catastrophe of wreckage piled upon wreckage, which is the line from the ninth thesis of Walter Benjamin before he committed suicide. The pile of debris. You see it in DeLillo novels. You see it in Pynchon and so forth and so on. What do you do in the face of that? Well, the blues say, oh, wait a minute. You know, the blues ain't nothing but autobiographical chronicle of personal catastrophe expressed lyrically anyway. Right? That's what they said. Nobody loves me but my mama, and she might be jiving too. That's B.B. King. That's the king of the blues. That's Antigone. Everything's against you in the darkness, including your blessed mama. Right? And he does that on the B side of The Thrill Is Gone. Thrill is gone. Thrill is gone. Flip it over. There's 1 minute and 24 seconds of Nobody Loves Me But My Mama. She might be driving too. That's B.B. King. And it comes from a people, a blues people, who have dealt with catastrophe in America, American terrorism in the form of slavery for 244 years, American terrorism in the form of Jim Crow, Jane Crow, lynching. King, it comes out of a tradition. Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker, so does Curtis Mayfield, so does Luther Vandross, so does a whole host of folk, Ray Charles, Stevie Wonder. The people saying, in the face of that kind of terrorism, you don't create a black Al-Qaeda and just counter-terrorize. You say, no, in the face of slavery, we want freedom for everybody. In the face of Jim Crow, we want rights and liberties for everybody. It's the love supreme that John Coltrane talked about. Amen. In the face of that kind of catastrophe, you hold on to some sense of what appears to be impotent, namely love and justice. Why? Because even when you're gangsterized, you don't want to get in the gutter with the gangster. Even if you're defeated momentarily, you'd rather be defeated with integrity than win with the thugs. That's the lesson of the best of black history in America. And of course, America wouldn't be what it is in terms of people dealing with these catastrophes, overwhelmed, weary, and yet still somehow persisting, even if that for the moment sometimes all you can do is sing a song. That's what the spirituals were, right? Black people had no rights, no liberties, no land, no territory, couldn't worship God without white supervision in the land of religious liberty. What did they do? They stole away deep in the night, held hands in a ring shout, and these non-literate folk sang spirituals. Steal away, steal away. That's a profound human lesson. We need that lesson in the age of terrorism and in the age of depression. So our elites say the recession is over, maybe for Wall Street, but not Main Street.
That's right.
It's getting deep. Unemployment, underemployment, catastrophe, the wreckage that we're talking about. How do we muster the courage to still think critically for ourselves, still love in the deepest sense? In the deepest way, Walter Rauschenbusch talked about it. Steadfast commitment to the well-being of others, especially the least of these, echoes of the 25th chapter of Matthew that Sister Mary was talking about in terms of feeding the poor, the prisoners, and so forth, you see. And that's, I think, it's not so much a lesson, it's a bearing witness and trying to have a memory, or what Toni Morrison would call a rememory in Beloved. To keep that remembrance of a witness of a love and a justice in the face of the most extraordinary catastrophic circumstances. Why? Because the catastrophe is coming to each and every one of us. Be it the death of your mommy, the death of your child, your death, the death of your friend, your community going under, unemployment hitting your community,
No health care for you. When you lose your job, sooner or later, catastrophe becomes your companion. It's just that in certain communities, it is an intimate companion. You've had a long time dealing, but I'm sorry to go on so long. But that's my answer.
It's music, Cornell. Thank you.
Oh, indeed, indeed.
Pick up on somebody that you mentioned, David Hume, though, because
yes,
I'd like
yes.
to give atheism its day.
Please.
That is to say, atheists are not just Christopher Hitchens. There are a lot of very honorable atheists.
Oh, yeah.
And David Hume came to his position after great soul-searching and wouldn't even take the consolation on his deathbed. He said, I'm not going to do it. So I think one of the places that we are as postmodernists are we're post-Holocaust people, we're post-World War I, we're post-Rwanda. It isn't a foolish or ignoble position to say there cannot be a loving God. The suffering in this world makes anybody who thinks there's a loving God just a fool, and I won't do it. And I will not invoke a loving God. I will not invoke some realm in which all tears are dried, because that betrays the people who were killed in Auschwitz, who were killed in Rwanda, all the slaves. So I think that, all religious people aren't fabulous and all atheists are not just selfish idiots. The spectacle of human suffering must lead us to call into question the goodness of the universe and the goodness and the possibility of the divine. It seems to me that I had one of the best women I knew was absolutely, she had a great appetite for life. She had two phrases. She would always go into the ocean. She said, two things you never regret, a swim in the ocean and the birth of a child. And she would go into the ocean no matter how cold it was. And she was full of life. And she didn't believe in God at all. It made her very impatient. And when she was dying, her beloved granddaughter, whom she most loved, said, oh, Nana, I'm going to miss you so much. And she looked at her and she said, where I'm going, I'm not going to miss anything. And she was perfectly content that this world was the end of it. She was a person who was devoted to justice. She loved life. She loved her children. She loved the ocean. There was no way in which her atheism made her a less rich human being than Tammy Faye Baker, you know? I guess I want to kind of stand up for the possible integrity of an anti-religious position.
I mean, Chekhov and Beckett. You got more love in Chekhov and Beckett than most Christian churches.
Right.
I'll introduce one sentence in favor of atheists, too, now that we're sort of getting consensus here. Atheism, Paul Tillich said, is always the shadow of some understanding of God.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me which God you don't believe in. I probably don't believe in that one either. Atheists do us a lot of favors, and they keep raising the kind of questions you've raised just now about the loving God. But going back to Cornell's favorite text, how does a loving God let Jesus Christ continue to die on the cross and not intervene?
Absolutely.
At that critical moment in history? What kind of a loving God is that? It's a loving God who says, I'm not going to save you from your own problems. This world is your world. I'm turning it over to you. And I'm not going to intervene, because the only kind of respect and response I want is a free and not a coerced response. That's a favorite text of mine, too, by the way. Also, the favorite text.
Hume's dialogue should be read at least once a year, preferably around Easter.
It was Dietrich Bonhoeffer's favorite text.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
This is God
but
saying,
Hume must be read over against Dostoevsky, though, and the Brothers Karamazov, especially the Grand Inquisitor, because I mean, what the genius of Hume, and Hume is the finest philosophic mind in the English language, better than Bertrand Russell, even more than Alfred North Whitehead. He's Scott, too, I'm going to add that. That his genius is what, there's no theoretical resolution to this problem of evil.
No, right.
And if you think you have a theoretical resolution, you've got some sophomore dogma you're holding on to for dear life, and you're going to crash. You see.
The only response is like the conclusion of a practical Aristotelian syllogism, which is not a proposition but a way of life, action. In the same way Dostoevsky responded, what? Here are the holy fools. Look at the lives they lived. Examples are the go-kart of justice. Look at the lives, look at the virtues exemplified in their lives. They don't have a theoretical resolution to a loving God and suffering in the world. All they have is an exemplary response to it. And that's why it's usually the lapsed Christians like Chekhov or Beckett. I had Beckhoff, isn't that nice? Oh, I love that slip. But it also, it's the acknowledgement of failure built into even your example. You see, when Beckett says, try again, fail again, fail better, in Wordsworth Hope, that last great prose fiction of his, failing better is a major achievement. Because everybody falls short in the end. You could have loved more, you could have served more, you could have done more. I have one slight disagreement with you, my dear sister. One of the sisters said she never regrets giving birth to a child. Now, you know Stephen Sondheim's mother? You remember when she was going into, she was saying that never regrets giving birth to a child. The greatest playwright of song America's ever produced, Stephen Sondheim, just like the greatest playwright in word is Eugene O'Neill. And both of them had mothers who regretted that they gave birth to them.
But we don't regret it.
Very interesting. When Sondheim's mother was going in for a double bypass, they said, would you like to say anything? She said, I have one sentence to write. I have no regrets in life other than giving birth to you and gave it to Steve. No, but we laugh. That's not funny. That's not funny at all. But for me, because that's a level of the blues that even as a black person, I can never experience. And my mother loved me in ways I can't describe. And when you look at passion, when you look at what he's doing into the woods, when you look at folly and look at company, and you see how he's going into the deep sides of Hammerstein and Rodgers in ways that's unprecedented in the history of musical theater. And the same is true with O'Neill in terms of his mother and Long Day's Journey. So that there are some women who really regret giving birth. That they don't all
they probably didn't like swimming either, though.
Cornel West, Mary Gordon, Harvey Cox. That's how you make an hour go past.
Is the hour up already?
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Harvey Cox, whose book is The Future of Faith, with Mary Gordon, whose non-novel is Reading Jesus, and Cornel West, who co-writes his own spiritual journey in Brother West. Thanks to the Boston Book Festival for bringing them and me together. Leave your own notes on the religious pulse as you feel it, in public life, in private life, at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining the conversation.